Blog Talk Radio.
Something about that. It was never really explained to me what I ought to do with that. And it's only been, many years on, where you're listening to a person that has regrets. I can't think of anything else, because if I go through life and I add experience, and as I add experience, and as I become aware of my own history, I can certainly say there are a lot of things that I would do different because I have that advantage of hindsight. My goodness, of course. So when I hear fellows very much in earnest trying to convince, they say it unconvincingly, I have no regrets in life. And I think, I'm not really sure who they're trying to convince. It doesn't really connect with the reality of things, because I think I'm simply looking at it as then and now, and then is in the imagination, it's gone, it's yesterday. The benefit is that I can reflect on that and do things a little better, as Quincy Jones would say, a little better today than yesterday. And so I want to use all that practice and the the failures, the disasters, the experiments that went sideways. I use that. I have that advantage, not just to wallow in self-pity and say, oh my goodness, you know, I'm describing that I've done things that that I'm not proud about. Well, I think the only way to advance, was Nietzsche said something about this, the only true way to advance is by understanding a true sense of myself and the world around. And that's not something I want to sit down and discuss with a room full of people. But here, there's that veil of what's the word, invisibility, that allows us to connect on that in that kind of a way. It's hard to do that, to be able to do that. And then not be sitting there in judgment, but be appreciating that capacity to understand. Simply to understand yourself. It's not only a belief; it's my observation. That we do that best when we realize we need to be gentle with ourselves, because inside that conversation happening in our mind, we might not have the filter. We might not be able to filter out the cruelty that can happen. We can burden ourselves unfairly, in a way that we wouldn't do with anybody else in the world. And is completely undeserving. And then who am I to say, of course? Well, I'm saying here, doing that and wallowing or continuing on some dilemma or some demons from the past, that's wrong. There you go. And you find out the reasons why. It's not for me to justify it. I can simply tell you, explain to you. It's understandable, but it's wrong. Your potential is so much more, and the credit goes to you and your intelligence. And I'm reminded, and I don't think it's a rationalization, I'm reminded of that beautiful story that's told about the Buddha, how his dad tried to keep him indulged so he'd have all the pleasures of the world and therefore not need to venture out. It would be a good and faithful and loyal son, and a successful prince and eventually a ruler, and not need to venture out. But, you know, he was, as I recall the story, he was being shepherded between locations and happened to, outside of a screen, to witness the degradation of the streets, utter poverty, the suffering of people, which caused a pang of conscience and prompted this man who had lived in luxury to begin a pilgrimage, to go out and see for himself, to experience. And he did, until one day, as the myth is told for us, he sat down under a tree to contemplate. What the message for me, there's some beauty in that. I do like the story. But the message is about understanding and about coming to grips, not with just creating a pretend world. I don't live in a fantasy land. When I do things, the music, I'm not like a program on the television where romantic music swells up in the background every time I do something. I'm putting a fire on, or I'm cutting the lawn. Or I'm washing the car. There's no, it is what it is. And I prefer that because the challenge is to try and transcend my own reaction. I find some things going on, for example, there's some things going on in the world are repugnant, but that's me. That's me. I don't know exactly what's going on, but I have impressions that are given to me. And I don't think it's paranoia. I think it's quite realistic. Things in the world around is always influenced by the people telling the stories. I don't think that's any different, and I wouldn't have it any other way. If I'm too trusting, which I've been criticized for, then that's something I'll need to be alert to. If I'm too cynical, well, then that's something I need to be alert to. We come to terms, and especially as we the good fortune, we can look back as we age. It's quite wonderful. And now, it's like less concern about fitting my thinking in with whatever is trendy in the room to actually understanding my own thoughts. And then I can, if I need, to compare them. But I find that the older I get, the less I need to do that. It's like I attempt in my own plodding way to apply ethics to my life and in life and to my thinking. I have tried for quite some time, and I owe this advice to this piece to a friend of mine, Lindsay, Dr. Lindsay John, a lovely guy, a good friend through my university days, and also a bit of a shit at times, but the advice was to associate, surround myself with people that are going to in some way enhance or stimulate or be of some benefit to me. They're going to bring out traits that are healthy for me, and I thought at the time that was, I hadn't even considered that. I know, like you, I've had people that will only talk with me if they can get something out of it. There's a political agenda, you know that. I accept that that's part of life. But I choose not to surround myself with that kind of guy anymore. I prefer to people who are curious to me, who are doing their own researches, have their own model of life and values and struggle. I do find that very, very enjoyable, but without being self-conscious about the whole process, don't get me wrong. The lifestyle, adapting the lifestyle of a craftsman is a really interesting experience, don't you think? If I subscribe to these ideas, which I believe I do, then I live in it. I'll tell you this short story. I live in an area, or I've experienced masonry in this area, where it has been carelessly stated that masonry is voluntary, and that if there were any challenges put forward to members, many in the context of accountabilities, that would create a surge of people resigning and leaving. And I thought, I had difficulty with that from the beginning, because I felt this is not a voluntary. I, like you, come forward of my own free will and accord. That's not voluntary. That's my own free will and accord. Voluntary is something else. You're presenting a task and asking for somebody to step up. Nobody's presented a task. Nobody has presented a task. I did. And the craft is there, and I was curious. No, the difficulty for me, the struggle was about this notion of obligation. Men were in earnest with me. This is completely voluntary. We cannot do what you're suggesting. Yes, we know it makes sense, but we can't do it, because with volunteers, they'll quit. And of course, I pivoted around the matter of obligation. You and I did that. And however those other fellows may treat their obligation, it is not an option. It's not optional. It creates duty. No, I know that might sound strange to somebody who has assumed that they're there because, you know, and they can walk away. Well, absolutely. But as I say, the duties are aligned with this notion of development, not as flattery, not to say you're wonderful in every way, and therefore we're going to praise you. No, we're going to encourage you here. There's no praise. There's encouragement with difficult matters. And I think, I agree. There's a whole segment of the population who aren't contemplative. The life is easy. It's light. Who would I be to interfere with that kind of thinking? Except I don't find the conversation at all engaging, because it's not so much that I can manipulate or manufacture a different world by pretending, but the reality is there's some challenges. And what I do, our obligation is, I think, about what we do with those challenges and how we face them. I guess I'm in an area where a great many men walk away from their commitment to their partner. I think it's a little over 50% in the country that I'm in. And I'm probably like a lot of you, I would think. Not to condemn. If you've been through, a separation, that's very unpleasant and burdensome. My goodness, but you also know about commitment and the need to find that compatibility in life, and the sorrow of the fellow who is always blaming his shortcomings on his partners. That may well be, they may be the most terrible person in the world. However, it's your life is going to be determined by your what you learn and how you progress. And I think that's a darn good thing. We've got an interesting, and again, a bit of self-indulgent commentary to you. The only problem with merit is me. I'll tell you about that in a minute. And the poetry today is it's Samuel Taylor Coleridge, that romantic period poet, and he's helping us understand when imagination and reality become one. So if I think, and I wondered, is that like setting a challenge? You know, that's something I really want to do. So that's in my imagination. And then creating, I guess is the word, what we call self-discipline, motivating myself to do it. And knowing that for most things that are important, it's not a one-off. I have the attention span of a newt. But there's some things that I just pivot back to, you know, and I'm not quite sure always the why of it. But I just enjoy that I come back to these themes. The material that I read, it's like I look at it, like if I look at your library shelves, would I think, man, those guys, weird. I look at what you're reading. We're of an age where you're reading history and philosophy, and you're starting to apply concepts to yourself. You're working. Your conversation is about ideals. And what kind of a foolish person would do that? We know that no one actually, in reality, isn't achieving ideals. But we also know it's a matter of the striving toward the ideal, the unattainable. And I think for a lot of men that I've met, that seems to be a common trait I've met in the craft. But I've also, like you, have met those men outside the craft. They just have that je ne sais quoi. I struggle with this, that they're significant or they're special in some way. They're exceptional. And the beauty of it is, for me, there is a beauty. I see some fellows that are all over. We're in a landmass the size of, we can put Britain in this landmass, our jurisdiction, what, 2.5 times, something like that, you can tell. And they seem to be everywhere. And I don't realize, do they not have a life? But I also realize what they're showing me. They're showing us a dedication. And a consistency and a dedication to the craft. And I do admire that. I do. And yeah, I'm not talking about the fellas that have to rush to every photo op and want me to see a picture of their morning breakfast. I know I'm a horrible old guy, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the overarching kind of thing, that drive year by year, and I admire that. They're dedicated to, and they're showing the world, they're showing us that dedication, and I do truly like it. I do. I find that fascinating. However, as you know, I'm of a mind that you follow your own path, not mine, not what I subscribe to. You follow whatever tickles your fancy, whatever your objective is, whatever your opinions are about. In the craft, you can find that appeal and follow it up as far as you need be. If you're a bit of a gadfly like me, you'll find that you follow things through. You can begin to look at source material of these sources of these ideas, which I find fascinating. But then the ideas seem to shift in my thinking, and all of a sudden I'm moving into another area or related area of study, related because it's inside the framework of the craft. And I remember years ago, like many of you, I suspect, where I'm looking at some time references completely unrelated to masonry. And all of a sudden, I recalled that I knew a hell of a lot about that time period because I had been reading through material of the craft. And I was quite chuffed. I know it's silly, but I was quite chuffed. Today, though, you'll sit back and be regaled. We will be, by the work of a guy that this poet, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, interesting guy, and his poem today is "The Frost at Midnight," and I think it's compelling. We'll get into why. I don't know if you or the audience that needs to know or be reminded about what memory does to our sensibility or to our spirituality, the magical side of that, of memory, and the magic that comes with the effect on the mind of of poetry and what the poet does for us in terms of expansions and why it's worth the effort. Mm-hmm. And it's like a lot of things. Who am I to say that the world would be better off if everybody doesn't do everything all the time? But we do. We do. I'll end the round it off. We'll end with the cap or with history. Mm-hmm. Can't get too far away from history. And as we know, we're talking about the friction, the granularity between that aristocratic lodge and that la candeur and that riffraff lodge, Saint-Genevieve. I'm embellishing just slightly, and we'll see what we can learn from their quarrels. And the Grand Lodge weighed in. The Grand Lodge of France weighed in on that. So, lots on the go today. But first, before we go any further, can't we just sit back and savor a little bit of? Can't we sit back and savor a little bit of? Music, yeah, a little bit of that mathematics. Here, this is Ben Webster, Oscar Peterson. Check it out. Problem with merit. Merit, where we earn it. It's based on our improvements. Realizing we are part of an organization that runs on merit is game-changing for most, if not all of us. The Holy Grail that puts Machiavelli in his place. The declaration the world is not cynical after all. Some of us are proof of that. I don't think I consider myself proof. It seems almost luxurious to appreciate what initiation has done. Merit. From time to time, I enjoy delusions as much as the next man. My team is always the best. My choices are always better. And I am, like you, equipped with an intellect that can turn truth into a convenient acknowledgement of that. So many writers have confirmed what we already knew on the subject. The problem with merit is the problem with truth, and by extension, the problem of masonry. It is based on truth. That is more certain than I am. While I put a pin in that thought, something strange happens. I proceed to observe the world using that lens. If I am any example, it is realizing as I advance in life, I become aware of how much I do not know. Fortunately, I live in a world of experts on anything and everything, ready to tell me how I ought to function. Taking us literally by the hand, masonry introduces us to the neighbors. Over there is history, next to philosophy. There are men finding answers and men walking by. Knowing that is a lesson in itself. The ubiquitous journey of Masons has a destination, but not an ending. Every day the world is different, and we are too. Where there is struggle, I would suggest answers are likely to be found in places we formerly had never considered. Like looking in the mirror. Yeah, I think that. Does that make sense to you? believe. Hard to believe. George Shearing, just gorgeous music. Just gorgeous. Oh. Here, a piece of poetry. I want to start with just an introduction from written by a woman presented as a paper in the university in 10th of November, 2016, a woman by the name of Jill Matthews. And she comments on the consciousness of reality through poetry, if you don't mind. I found it was just beautiful. Reality is the state in which things exist independently rather than in imagination. But it is so broadly defined, therefore the lines between fact and fiction is blurred. Along with the vastness of its conception, reality is also unique to its beholder, like beauty or perception. One person's actuality differs from his or her neighbor's. Furthermore, a person spends his or her life living in his or her own world. I think this person's listened to Masonic Effects. Worlds can be described in many diverse ways, but none more successful than poetry. Poetry pushes the boundaries of language by painting pictures, evoking emotion, and increasing the understanding of collaborative universes, especially with romantic influence. Poetry is redefined as a means of connection in a complex world. One technique exercised by romantic poets is the application of a double consciousness to add depth of character and complexity to his or her work. I'll leave you with that. Here today, we're going to attempt that a willing suspension of disbelief. That's a phrase that we credit to Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And you'll hear that in university classes, the liberal arts, widely, especially if you're sitting looking at a movie or a play. There needs to be, we have that sense of reality, but there, you have to willingly suspend that to believe that the Montagues and the Capulets were feuding, and that their children were paying the price for that feud in a way. Thank you, Romeo and Juliet. Yeah. Here the work is today is from this fellow, the Romantic era poet. And you remember, the Romantic poets are referred to because this was a time when the expression of emotion was, I don't know if the term is allowed or what's happening. And can you imagine? And if you look back through history, you see before that, writings didn't include any mention of self, of how a person felt about a particular thing. It was much more descriptive of phenomena. And here the Romantic poets, it's like the Impressionist art, you know, the idea was there, the color was there, but it took artists to bring it forward. Similarly with this sense of the romance, the expression of emotion. And today we seem quite comfortable with that. We see that kind of emotional intensity in our selection of music and the arts. And anyway, you get the point. Here, Coleridge famously defined imagination as the human mind's temporary replication of the divine creation of the world. Yeah, I love that. Don't you? Don't you want to just sit down and have a glass of wine with his phone and say, what? Where did that come from? As he explains, the primary imagination I hold to be a repetition of the finite mind of the eternal action of creation. In other words, the human mind's creative powers, finite as they are, imitate in miniature the divine words that call the world into being. Oh, yeah. And it refers to the poem we're going to get into today. In Frost at Midnight, Coleridge meditates on creation by pairing poetic composition with the magical appearance of frost crystals on the windowpane and eaves outside. For those who haven't seen this phenomena, when there's moisture, a little bit of moisture, these geometric forms appear very, very tiny. And they appear can appear over entire surfaces, but no two of them will be the same. Mm. And if this happens up in the atmosphere, they fall to Earth as snowflakes. And each one of them is quite distinct. Each one. Now, somebody noticed that. Of course, we all notice it when we're children. And we notice it, and science takes that seriously. What is it, and how is it? I won't get into that. It is interesting. But here, Coleridge explores how the individual mind mirrors the natural world and shows how patterns repeat at different scales, revealing universal elements underlying landscapes, thought structures, and frost crystals, and poetry. So at the beginning of the poem, the speaker sits awake in the dead of night as frost leases the window. Everyone else has gone to bed, and his infant son, Hartley, sleeps by the low fire. An old English word for frost, rime, R-I-M-E, survived in rural northern English dialects. And in the late 18th century, around the time Coleridge was writing, it came into use once again, mostly among poets. Because it sounded like rhyme, R-H-Y-M-E, it provided fodder for symbols and wordplay. Both poetry and frost create complex interwoven patterns, and both arise in secret out of mystery. During long winter nights, frost spreads unseen up windows and across the grass. People once explained its glittering sudden appearance by saying, "That's Jack Frost, a rascally fairy tale character said to delight in bringing snow and sleet." Sleet is when the wind gets at it and it's blowing, instead of coming straight down, it's blowing sideways. And you can see it, all these little specks. They had painted intricate white designs while the whole house slept. So Coleridge forges poetic patterns to represent the workings of memory and imagination. And as he describes the frost, he poetically mimics it, recurring shapes. Looked at closely, frost patterns vary, but repeat the same basic designs, the little geometries, branching up the window and replicating himself. And the poem begins by evoking a repeated bird call in the winter silence. The frost performs its secret ministry. Shall we? Shall we indulge a bit just in this? Sure. I'll try not to. Oh, the poetry is over. It's about 74, 75 lines. I'm not sure we're going to get into this. But think about this. This is the fellow who wrote this, February 1798. He put it out. And then 30 years later, it was he rewrote it. The final version of this that we're looking at here, it was done in, he did it 1829. Mm. And you can see, you can still pick up the original piece, 1798, and compare if you choose to. The frost performs its secret ministry. Let's see how successful he is. Unhelped by any wind, the owlet's cry came loud, and hark again, loud as before, the inmates of my cottage, all at rest, have left me to that solitude which suits abstruser musings, save that at my side my cradled infant slumbers peacefully. 'Tis calm indeed, so calm that it disturbs and vexes meditation with its strange and extreme stillnesses. Sea and hill and wood, this populous village, sea and hill and wood, with all the numberless goings-on of life, inaudible as dreams. The thin blue flame lies on my slow-burnt fire and quivers not, only that film which fluttered on the grate still flutters there, and soul unquiet thing. Methinks its motion in this hush of nature gives it dim sympathies with me who live, making it a companionable form, those puny laps and flaps and freaks, the idling spirit. But its own moods interprets everywhere echo or mirror seeking of itself and makes a toy of thought. But oh, how oft at school with most believing mind, presageful have I gazed upon the bars to judge that fluttering stranger, and as oft with unclosed lids already had I dreamt with my sweet birthplace and that old church tower whose bells, the poor man's only music, rang from morn to night, evening, all the hot fair day so sweetly that they stirred and haunted me with a wild pleasure falling on mine ear, most like articulate sounds of things to come. Therefore all seasons shall be sweet to thee, whether the summer clothe the general earth with greenness, or the red breast sit and sing betwixt the tufts of snow on the bare branch of mossy apple tree, while the night watch smokes in the sun thaw, whether the eavesdrops fall, heard only in the trances of the blast, or if the secret ministry of frost shall hang them up in silent icicles, quietly shining to the quiet moon. To those last few lines he took out. The last six lines. What do you think? Did it work? Somebody can take an observation that you see, something real, and draw it toward imagination. And I guess, why not? I don't know. What do we do? Does it teach us things? It teaches some people things. Here. Little Keith Jarrett. Keith Jarrett was quite an accomplished performer for many, many years. And now we remember his work. I think he's recovering from a stroke, if I'm not mistaken. Such a talent. Thank you. Keith Jarrett. Quite the talent. And I have to admit, I do enjoy hearing him sing. I call it singing. Carrying on his tones in the background of this piece. It's just beautiful. Let me take you back in time to a story about lodges and differences and some tensions that arose. I think this reflects more, rather than just the composition of La Grandeur Lodge and the Saint-Genevieve Lodge, I think it's also a reflection of social tensions, because one was the aristocrat pointing fingers at this other, letting in all manner of people into the craft. Now, I think there's some, it's a reminder that the priority of the craft isn't the same in every point in time. It changes. And I think as it's distilled, as the craft is distilled, the priority begins to take shape. And I think I don't think that's something that's done with animus in mind. I think that has more to do with the organicity, the organic growth of lodges. Here, we're going to be talking about, we're going to examine, history allows us to examine this without necessarily feeling that we have to relate it to something going on in our own lodges, some of that, you know, that pettiness that happens. And we don't like to talk about it, quite right, but it is, at the end of the day, if we look at it historically, it's like the blink of an eye. It really doesn't matter. But knowing that, knowing what we do or having these observations, we also need to realize that doesn't change the world around us. It doesn't change other people's perceptions. They are, and you may know, you may see it, you'll see their limits, just like they see ours. That's the exchange. The craft, like any good partnership, is the learning to tolerate those things. I tolerate your tedious sense of humor, and you tolerate mine. And that we tolerate your tastes in art or your lack of taste in art, and you tolerate mine. And that's what we call friendship, tolerance. Here, let me start. But like many lodges, Saint-Genevieve, the Riffraff Lodge, I say that tongue-in-cheek, was involved in the establishment of new lodges. A lodge's legality depended upon the recognition of other legally constituted lodges, as it makes sense. In 1782, a lodge of doctors and surgeons and students of medicine was established with the assistance of Saint-Genevieve, which represented the Grand Orient of France. Although of many national backgrounds, these young and largely Catholic medical men were united by their occupations and, in most cases, their military service. Completing the lodge were military officers and a few lawyers. At the ceremony which created Les Beaux-Arts, the master of Saint-Genevieve explained that I hold with dignity the commission with which I have been charged by the Masonic Central Administration in Paris. It sought to ensure the regularity of the work of all lodges to its regime. The master also had another purpose. It was to instruct the new lodge for the morale of the Grey. This symbolic grade were meant to enhance the purity of the brothers' lives. It is essential that you have a perfect knowledge of the qualities of spirit and the heart of a candidate. Whatever quarrels Saint Genevieve may have had with the Grand Lodge in the past are forgotten in its ardor to see that the new lodge give to it a submission without limits and inviolable attachment, the prompt execution of degrees. With that statement, the master presented the new lodge with letters patent of constitution. Le Beaux-Arts, he explained, should have an immense happiness at being members of a society of virtuous men. In the sweetness of an intimate union that brings you together with a multitude of persons of all ages and ranks, including some of the highest ranks, under the protection of illustrious leaders who preside over the order, in the satisfaction of finding everywhere a people of brothers eager to serve you, and to give, in turn, their most tender affection to you. Boutique lodges. I don't find that that's a complication, although some people might. I don't find that it's a complication. It makes sense. Like-minded, you want your mates to be together and having something in common. It seems to make sense. And the stratification, I don't find that difficult. Once upon a time, I might have, but I don't now. Each lodge to its own. Every lodge, when we look at the expression of authority, like how are we going to enforce the regularity, you can see that some grand lodges are more intellectual about it. Some are more, what's the word, authoritative? But authentic, I think I can add, the authenticity of a Grand Lodge rests in the values, how those landmarks reflected in its thinking and its relationship, the relationship it develops with the membership. Some seem to be very strict, and some seem to be very laissez-faire, and both seem to have application. That's not to say that the Grand Lodge interpretation is to be restricted. No, it's certainly not. Nor is it to say that within districts or within lodges themselves that interpretations should be somehow controlled, because that's not the case. Finding that essence, that balance, and that pivot point, I believe, strengthens your lodge. I think that's where confidence comes out. Not so much about who's in charge and whose will prevails, but the reasoning behind the decisions. And not just that, but the setting up a framework, a process that acknowledges the need for discussion, the need for allowances, dissenting opinion, having the flexibility. And if you make the basis of this merit, then you've committed, a whole group of men have committed themselves to a serious challenge, the discovery of truth, the sense of reality. In each mind, a sense of reality about his own strengths and abilities, weaknesses, foibles, and with the universe around, including in that universe, the lodge, acknowledgement. Some will find that overwhelming, and others will shrug their shoulders and say, well, so now what? We begin to realize that we are of the same capacity. We have different talents. And thank goodness, my goodness, I couldn't imagine if everybody was like me. Oh my goodness. Pity everybody. Like that. Thank you. Again, I hope it's been entertaining and informative for you. And thanks for pulling up a bench and joining us in the lab here. The craft moves on. The core of it, I think, is optimism. I think it's, you know, trying to find the simple geometry of the craft. I think there's a marriage, the geometry of the mind and purpose and our sense and place in the universe. Optimistic, if I can say that, and think about all these protons floating around and these processes happening in the expanse, the infinity of space. I can sit and think these are thoughts that are very hard to understand, and then I can listen to pick up Goethe's work right here on Faust. I'll act as servant and fulfill my task, but one thing still, in case of life or death, I pray, give me a written line or two. That's a line from Goethe's Faust. That was Mephistopheles speaking. Give me a line or two. I hope you'll come back next week. We're getting to a very pivotal time we're getting to an equinox, aren't we? Are we? Solstice. Oh, equinox. Yes, my goodness. Coming up in a few days. I hope it goes well for you, finding that point, that balance in your life, however temporarily. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. It'll make you feel good, and it will benefit the world in ways that we often need. Let's support each other. Such a pleasure. Until next time, bye. Thank you.